And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Jahan Nujem, who is an Egyptian-American documentary film director, best known for her films Control Room, Pangea Day, and Startup.com, which won the 2001 Grand Jury Prize. Her latest film, The Square, was awarded the Sundance Audience Award for World Cinema Documentary, and it's up for this year's Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. And also joining us in the studio is the producer of The Square, Karim Amir. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jahan Nujem and Karim Amir.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
And so the film, of course, is banned in Egypt, right? And it hasn't been shown there. Is that right?
I wouldn't use the word banned because we are currently going through the process of resubmitting the film.
To censors?
Resubmitting the film to censors. What I would say is that it is politics wrapped up, disguised by bureaucracy. And so they have revolted about the use of the word ban because they've said, well, we haven't actually banned it, but we actually also haven't actually let it through. So we're going through the long and complicated process of submitting the film, resubmitting the film to censorship, and submitting all of the papers, the piles of papers that they now need. The way that it's probably going to turn out is that we are not going to be able to provide the papers to actually clear the film. So we're going to have to come out with a statement saying that the way that the laws are written, it's impossible to pass this film. But we went through this process. And that would be accurate. But in order for independent filmmakers and Egyptian filmmakers to release films, the laws are going to have to be changed.
And we feel that we need to take a position on this in this time, because if there's ever been an opportunity to put pressure on changing these regulations, it is right now, because this is the first Oscar nomination for an Egyptian film, and it's ridiculous that we are having, and anyone is having, to go through these types of things in a post revolution society, right? That we still have censorship in itself is questionable. You know, but once again, what we've seen is you know, the generational divide that cuts through Egypt, whereby there is the generation of the past that still believes that putting restrictions on a film or a piece of content or stopping freedom of expression is still a tangible way of ruling. And there is the reality, which is the millions of young people who have taken the film online, shared it, put it on torrent sites, over 100 different YouTube links and Vimeo links, and continue to pass it along. And I think that that's very reflective of the Egypt and the Middle East that we're increasingly seeing, between this battle of these two stories.
Between, like, the official media and guerrilla media.
Yeah. I mean, there's about 1.5 million views in Egypt now of the film. So it hasn't stopped anybody who wants to see the film from actually seeing the film. The reason why we're going through this somewhat, you know, ridiculous process is because we feel like if we can get the authorities to officially okay the film, we feel like that is a step towards freedom of speech in Egypt, because that is them okaying a film that, where they don't necessarily like the content of the film, which is what freedom of speech is, supporting something's right to exist even if you don't like what it's what's being said.
Especially now, though, because there is this kind of whitewashing of history that's currently happening by the power structure, where there's a kind of growing feeling that we can just press the reset button and go back to January 24, 2011 and pretend like none of this has happened.
Well, hasn't the military changed the constitution to put themselves above the law? And are there still, as they are in many other countries, where you have literally laws that say you cannot insult the military? And because the film shows some pretty unsparing footage of tanks rolling over Coptic Christian protesters, the military shooting people, dragging bodies and throwing them into dumpsters. I don't imagine the generals are too happy with this film.
They're not, I haven't spoken directly to them, but these images are available online everywhere. They're also in the film. They're the reality of what happened. I don't think that they are thrilled about what's in the film. However, if we are actually moving towards this democratic nation that they are saying we are moving towards, then they have to accept and support this film. Now, if that may be called naive and optimistic by many people, but we have to continue on this struggle, because by just throwing up our hands and giving up, we are neglecting you have to look towards the possibility. The possibility is that this film has now been Oscar nominated. It's like going to the World Cup. It's like the authorities want to stand behind this because this is something that represents the pride for Egyptians. At the same time, it contains images and realities that, as Karim said, are trying to be whitewashed.
Well, it holds a mirror to the power structure, and it's a mirror that I think that, you know, in Egypt, it's tanks and guns and stopping of freedom of speech, and members ex-members of parliament who are currently being arrested for a tweet that's insulting the judiciary. So it's very kind of black and white. But I think that in general, this taps into a deeper issue about many societies that are oftentimes unwilling to have the mirror be held so close to the events. You know, I mean, this is a film that's about events that are continuing to unfold, and which we finished shooting this summer. So it's very close to the scars that have still kind of haven't been healed yet in Egypt. But I think that if we look even in this country, we were talking with a fellow filmmaker, and they were saying, you know, well, 12 Years a Slave is a great film, but would Americans be as accepting of a film that brings of the 12 Years a Slave story about today? I mean, it's a narrative that doesn't hold the current society accountable whatsoever, right? It holds a past generation accountable, and that nobody's kind of going to stand against. But what about the issues? What about the stories that hold that mirror up closely today? Are societies ready for them? And I think that that's one of the things that why we have to push this, because while this is about Egypt, it's also about kind of standing for pushing these alternative stories to be out there, because we can't keep continuing having this situation where history is only written by the victors. We live in a world now where we are interconnected, where we have access to free media, where we have the ability to give a microphone to the quiet voices, to the lonely voices in their fights, wherever they may be, whatever how distant the square is from where you live, and to stand with it in solidarity. So I think that's what's kind of driving our effort right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Jehan Nujem, who's an Egyptian-American documentary film director. Her latest film is The Square, which was awarded the Sundance Award, Audience Award for World Cinema Documentary, and it's up for this year's Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. And also joining us in the studio is the producer of The Square, Karim Amer. So at this point, you have 3 years after the revolution, and you say the film takes you up until last summer. But at this point, the latest chapter is, it seems to indicate the U.S. is completely isolated. I mean, apparently Chuck Hagel, the defense secretary, talks to General Sisi often, but he doesn't seem to get anywhere in these conversations. Now you've got Vladimir Putin of Russia sort of telling the generals, going, it's trying to seduce them, in effect, saying, you know, enter my orbit here, you know, and he's already calling for General Sisi to run for parliament, you know, I mean, to run for president. What do you make of that? I mean,
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, first of all, from that side, from the U.S. side of it, I think that American citizens need to be aware and have a stake in Egypt for two reasons. One is very basically, as the second largest recipient of direct U.S. aid, every person's tax money has a portion of it going to this country far away. And so I think that that's a direct kind of thing that where Americans who want to take action or be involved can put pressure on their Congress to have a more kind of direct relationship with what's going. Secondly, though, I think that what's at stake in Egypt is, you know, while we have the Muslim Brotherhood and the army and the rivalry that people see there, if we zoom out, we'll find that there's a more kind of global struggle happening. You know, when we see that the people are going down to the square in Egypt, and people are going down to the square in Kiev, and people are going down to the squares in Athens and in Rio and in Istanbul, and now maybe in Bosnia and Venezuela. We start to realize that something fundamental is happening here, right? And there is this kind of moment that's happening, this zeitgeist moment, whatever you want to call it, where people power is trying to rewrite the social contract. And when we start to see that it's a global issue, we start to realize that, well, maybe the culprits or maybe the forces that people are fighting against are not so local. Maybe they have local faces, but maybe there are some global issues that we should really start to talk about here. And maybe there's an interconnectedness between the successes and failures for the pursuit of basic civil rights and basic human rights in these countries. And then we start to realize that there maybe is a kind of responsibility that we have to shift a global consciousness and to start holding each other accountable. Because when we allow for, you know, a tear or a clampdown or a genocide to happen, it tears at that very fundamental fabric that connects us, that thread of humanity. And I think that that's what we have to start fighting against. And whatever government forces are standing to support the opposers of that, whether it be Putin, whether it be Assad, whether it be whoever, I think we have a responsibility to push against as citizens. Forget governments.
But it would seem, though, Jahan, that Putin is basically dangling the carrot of, you know, I will replace the American arms if you decide to switch back, which is what happened before the Camp David agreement, under the previous regimes in Egypt. Of course, they were supplied by the Russians, and I'm pretty sure that's the subtext here. And it doesn't seem like the American leverage over giving all this money is getting them anywhere, and I'm not sure whether or not how engaged they are, frankly, the John Kerry and company. But what I do understand is the fact is that Saudi Arabia is deeply engaged, that they, during the revolution, they funded the Salafists who came out of nowhere. And then during the Morsi government, apparently they conspired with the military to cut off the fuel supplies, the food supplies, and suddenly the minute that the Tamarod-inspired revolution brought the military back, suddenly gasoline shows up, food shows up, and billions of dollars come in from the Gulf, from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the Emirates. So as much as I admire what Karim just said, there are outside players that don't have, certainly in the case of Saudis, they're against democracy itself.
There are definitely outside players. And I mean, Karim and I have had many conversations with people in the government, people who have access to information, and it was something like $26 billion that was said to have been committed by Saudi Arabia, and another how many billion from China was given last year. So there are definitely outside forces at play.
I think, though, what I think about the American foreign policy side of it, though, at least, is that I think the issue we find here is, A, there's this kind of like, there's this tradition of America kind of having this, who's our man in such and such country? Who's our man in Egypt? Who's our man in Syria? Who's our man in Saudi? And I think that has time and time again shown its short sight and its failure, you know. And it's not about having a man in such and such country. It's about investing in the process. And I think that if America cannot shift its foreign policy in the 21st century and realize and learn from its mistakes in the past and start to say that if we don't invest in the actual policy, the actual infrastructure of democracy, the infrastructure of nations as well, if we don't invest in people, then we're always going to get stuck between which side are we on. It
sure.
Shouldn't be on different sides. It should be on the people's side.
Well, we also had our man in Egypt forever with Mubarak.
Absolutely.
And it looks like the fact that his dreadful son was going to inherit the throne like they do in North Korea, you know, that seemed to be was that the straw that broke the camel's back, do you think, that in many ways inspired the revolution that you've documented in your film, The Square?
I don't think that is what inspired the revolution. I mean, if you think about the original chant of why people went down to the square, it was not, we want to remove Mubarak, or we don't want to have his son be put in place. It was bread, freedom, social justice. People were looking for a much deeper change than just the removal of Mubarak, which is why our film begins with the removal of Mubarak, which is why we believe that that's actually where the story of change started. So I think that that's what people were looking for. People saw what was happening in Tunisia. People felt like if it can happen there, it can happen here too. People were completely fed up with the treatment of the police and, you know, huge uprisings had happened in June when Khalid Said had been brutally tortured by the police. So I think that all of those were instigators. Now, you know, did people look at the fact that there was a probability that Mubarak's son was going to take over and say, okay, that this is another element of this and this is not something that we like? Definitely. But do I think that that caused the uprising? No. I think it had been boiling for a long time.
But it did provide this. To me, it's why the military initially supported the protest movement, because Mubarak's son was, you know, we've been ruled in Egypt by 60 years of military rule, and Mubarak's son was detracting from the military rule and creating a Mubarak-only rule. He was, you know, trying. He didn't serve in the military and kind of looked down at the army. So they definitely, there was a lot of people who, and even in some of the interviews we did with some army officials, you know, they really did not like Mubarak's son and wanted a return to the army state, the great army nation that was forged in the 50s.
Well, I thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.